there's no privilege to repeating basic errors, you know, that we have done. We need to try to do better, and we must do better.
Hey, what's up? Welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And joining us from Phoenix, Arizona. Arizona, one of the all-time coolest states forever and ever and ever, is the fabulous Erika Andiola. She's an immigrant rights activist and chief advocacy officer for the organization Raices, which stands for Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, also one of my favorite organizations. And she's the host of their podcast, Homeland Insecurity. ¿Qué pasó, Erika?
Hola, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And joining us from Inglewood, California is Nana Jamfi. She is an attorney and executive director of also one of my all-time favorite organizations as well, the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. So welcome, Nana.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Good to have you here. All right, we're going to start with the latest that's happening, because in the last few weeks that Trump is serving as president, it's like he's still trying to fuck with immigration issues. Like, he's just like, it's not enough. I'm still going to mess with this. Mm. So just last week, the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice said that they were implementing new restrictions on immigrants seeking asylum. I'm like, bro, how much more can you restrict? Okay, how much more can you restrict? This is going to make it easier for people to be denied their asylum applications. Mm-hmm. The administration also rolled out a new citizenship test.
Sure.
That's longer and more difficult.
Just add that too.
Okay, and as if Trump could take the test, okay, and pass. Well, I mean, I'm sorry, it's the truth.
It's the truth.
Also, earlier in December, a federal judge ruled that the Trump administration must reinstate fully the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program known as DACA, which could affect around 1.3 million eligible people, according to the Migration Policy Institute. So, Erika, what can we expect in these final weeks of Trump's term? What is it like for you as you're watching what's going on? And what's your kind of temperature check?
Yeah.
I got to be honest, I got no patience, but what's going on for you?
Yeah, honestly, I am hoping, look, when it comes to policies, like, he has already done everything that, you know, he basically has wanted on immigration. Maybe he wants more, but he literally changed about 400 policies just on executive actions as a president. Right. And so he has changed immigration, especially asylum. Right. He wanted to end asylum for asylum seekers. And he's, you know, even until the end of his presidency, he's still rolling out policies to make it harder for people to come to the U.S. and to criminalize immigrants even more. And so we're going to see a lot more of that, unfortunately, until, you know, the end of his presidency. I hope he doesn't do any crazy things with ICE. And, you know, one thing I was talking to my colleagues about is, like, I just really hope he's not going to go out and, you know, do massive rates or anything like that, because that, you know, it's so scary for our communities. But I really think he's going to try to do everything in his power before he leaves office to leave a mess for the Biden administration.
Wow.
Nana, what's your feeling of what's going on at the end of the Trump era?
This is like one of those cartoons.
Yeah.
Though very much more serious.
Yeah.
Where, like, the evil character just keeps coming up with evil things to do, right? Mm-hmm. Like one of those shows of the past where it's like, let's boil them in oil.
Right, right. Roadrunner.
Let's throw them into a shark-infested ocean, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like clearly this intent to make sure that the lives of immigrants are as miserable as possible, to cause as much harm and trauma as possible. And, you know, when we look at Black immigrants specifically, we're looking at a population that's really disproportionately impacted by these rules. So the asylum rules and restricting it even more, even though this is U.S. law as well as international law, that there are certain categories of people that can seek asylum in this country. He's just, you know, gone completely against that and has people languishing and dying at the border, you know, because he can. And, you know, the cruelty is the point.
Yeah.
When you look at the visa restrictions, he has a visa restriction now for certain countries, and you'll notice what those countries are, many of them African countries, where he wants you to come visit your relatives to post a $15,000 bond. When we look at what decisions he's made with respect to keeping folks out and returning folks who are trying to come in, blaming it on the public health crisis that he doesn't believe in, by the way. Like, you don't believe in coronavirus, so I don't understand how you're pushing back unaccompanied minors and right. saying they can't come into the country because of coronavirus. Right. But again, the cruelty is clearly the point.
Yeah.
And this effort to keep this idea of the U.S. as a white ethno state, right, to appeal to that, make America white, not again, because it never was white, but make America white finally, is clear in all of the decisions he's making right now.
Right. And all of you have mentioned some of those examples, but looking at what we've seen in the last 4 years, I mean, Trump administration, crisis at the border, the systemic separation of families, the repeated attempts of rescinding the DACA program, talking about the cartoon. It's like, must rescind the DACA program. Like, let me do it this way. Right. And that, you know, things like that, you know, the mess, as everyone has said, it has had this real catastrophic human impact. And yeah, Erica, like what you said before, according to the Migration Policy Institute, Trump and the Trump administration made some 400 changes to immigration during his term, which I was like, whoa. But we also want to get into what policy will look like under the Biden-Harris administration. Now, President-elect Joe Biden has said in his first 100 days that he plans to introduce a bill with a pathway to citizenship for the roughly 11 million undocumented immigrants, as well as halt all deportations. He's been on record and he said that. But we also know that Biden did not include immigration as part of his top four priorities, which are listed as follows: the coronavirus pandemic, economic recovery, racial equity, and climate change. I would argue that immigration, it should be interconnected to all of those, but what am I, you know, I don't know anything about policy. But listen, also this story by NPR on Sunday reported that a person with knowledge of the transition conversations said it was intentionally left out talking about immigration because, and I'm quoting, immigration activists had become too adversarial. So here we go. There's this fear. And I mean, you know, Erica and I have talked about it several times. It's one of my ongoing conversations that Biden's plan is going to revert back to Obama era policies. But progressives are really using this moment to push for more comprehensive reform. Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's all like some pretty insane bullshit right there.
Yeah. No other way to put it.
I just like, well, I mean, because just the pettiness.
It's so petty.
The pettiness is that, oh.
We have two adversarial guests with us.
You know what? Yes. And in fact, Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington State plans to introduce a resolution once the new term begins in 2021, calling for these reforms from expanding immigrants' access to health care and housing to ending all deportations. And even if Biden does end up pushing for some of these reforms, there's a lot at stake.
Yeah.
The Georgia runoff elections in early January, of course, are going to determine whether the Democrats will get a Senate majority. And of course, with the new Supreme Court confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett, you've got a more conservative-leaning Supreme Court majority. That's just for real. So on one hand, you have some Democrats saying, you know, important reform is going to be too radical. And then on the other hand, you've got the Republicans, and we know where they kind of stand. So Nana, am I right about this whole thing? Like, you know, the time is now.
Yeah.
How many times have Black women, have they been told, you need to just wait. Am I right, Nana?
Absolutely. I mean, it is very clear from speaking with the transition team, like all of these meetings that folks are in and officially and unofficially, right? That the Biden administration is about to be to the right of Obama policies. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be Obama policies. I think that that is too high an expectation.
Wow.
My expectation is that it's going to be to the right.
Okay, that's frightening.
That people are so traumatized by what's happened.
You're saying it's going to be more in line to sort of more of a Trump lean than an Obama lean.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Because I think that, you know, people are so excited about the fact that it's not Trump because, you know, they just don't have the person that's sitting wringing their hands, coming up with all the ways to torture us, that anything looks like a lot. When you're talking about adversarial, you have organizations. And Maria, you know, I've talked about this. I feel like immigration rights organizations are being too collaborative.
yeah,
and are going out of their way too much.
Ooh, interesting.
Right.
To line themselves up with the Biden campaign and to sing the praises of Biden and Harris before they've even started, and to tell our communities that things are going to be, you know, it's like the end of The Wiz where they're crawling out of the, right, the gorilla outfits, and it's like, can you sing the brand new day? You know what I mean? And the sun is shining.
I am loving your comparisons. Right. Cartoons in The Wiz. Let's go.
You did know that Julio is like Broadway musicals, like, maniac.
I totally felt that.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what is being presented. And I feel like, no, actually, what we need to do is not present sort of like the orderly, we're trying to come to you, respectability politics, that he needs to be facing chaos and confusion. He needs to be looking around saying, I actually don't know which way these people are coming next. I better pay attention to what they're saying. Mm. And I think that when we look at how this administration spoke to Black people, remember he said,
look, what people don't know about me is I come from a state that's the eighth largest Black population in America. The eighth largest. I get 96% of that vote for the last 40 years. It's they're the folks, as they say it my way, brung me to the dance. That's how I get elected every single time.
Because he tries to use Ebonics.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Did you hear that audio?
Right.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. It was so disrespectful.
I know.
And he made it clear that he's not going to use the executive order to provide the basics for the people he claimed put him there. And it's almost a form of anti-Blackness itself for people in the immigrant rights field to feel like we're going to do better than African-Americans are with Biden. Come on now. Mm.
So we really cannot move forward. I think this is where the four of us are in agreement. And obviously, we're just too uppity to be thinking this way. You have got to grapple with your past.
Right.
You have to open your eyes and see it.
Yeah.
Right. Erica, your podcast, Homeland Insecurity, looks at the history of immigration and how it's been enforced mm-hmm. through the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah.
So in your first episode, you get into the formation of DHS post 9/11 mm-hmm. and how it ended up targeting immigrants.
Ziegler spoke up in that very first meeting and said, sir, we can't do this. This is anti-American. You can't go around and start arresting people and interrogating them on a thin pretext. This is not what we do as a country.
But Ziegler lost the argument. Americans didn't want to hear about gathering intelligence after 9/11. They wanted to see action. They wanted to see the tough guys actually being tough.
Ashcroft's pronouncements that we're going to use every tool we've got, and we're if they're terrorists are out there, they should be scared, and we're going to find them, and we're going to throw them in prison. All that stuff, I think, played very well to a public that was extremely scared and worried after 9/11.
Who cared if a few immigrants had their rights violated, if it kept everyone else safe? But that's a slippery slope. Stopping a common enemy at all costs might sound like a good idea, but the enemy of the government one day might be different the next. And once you made it okay to violate the civil liberties of certain groups of people, that's hard to walk back.
Right. And so, you know, what was happening then, because I lived right through it, right, is that it was not now enough to target Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, wait, Muslims are also immigrants. And so let's just go after everything right here, post 9/11.
Yeah.
And we know that anti-immigrant policy didn't start with Trump.
Right.
Hello, President Clinton. We don't have to go, you know, that far back. We all know and have very complex and yet unforgiving feelings for the Obama administration.
Absolutely.
Because of being so notorious. And for me, you know, it's not just that he was the deporter in chief. It's like, bro, you're a constitutional legal expert.
Mm-hmm.
You know that people are being denied their due process just because they weren't born in this country.
Yeah.
And, you know, while Biden has admitted the mistakes of the administration, finally.
Because it made a mistake. It took too long to get it right. I'll be president of the United States, not vice president of the United States.
He also admitted these policies will take time.
Mm.
This whole thing of like, oh, it takes time.
Don't rock the boat.
I'm like,
yeah.
you know, I'm tired of that. I'm not going to take that as an excuse, not as a journalist, but as my responsibility as an American.
Yeah.
So, Erica, knowing this history and Biden's own past record, I mean, how are you processing how this new administration can really deal with the problems that Trump has created if they don't say we were part of the problem, too?
Yeah. Look, first of all, they definitely have to admit that they were part of the problem. I mean, you know, one of the things that we try to do with the podcast was like looking at the history of immigration, not necessarily in a partisan lens. This is literally like us telling the story, you know, starting from 9/11. Obviously, there's a lot of anti-immigrant crap that happened before 9/11, too. But starting from 9/11, it was Bush and then Obama and then Trump. And then here comes, you know, our next president, Biden. And to me, if they don't acknowledge everything that went wrong, first of all, the fact that they were trying to pass legislation in Congress, quote unquote trying, I really don't think they were trying, but they said that they were trying by enforcing immigration in a way that was completely inhumane to try to get, you know, Republicans on board or try to get some of the centrist Democrats on board. And that created this huge deportation machine that now was handed over to Trump so that he could make it even worse, right? And so they have to not just acknowledge that, they also have to act on it, right? And what makes me so frustrated right now in the conversation that happened on Twitter with the NPR article that just came out is, you know, when I saw the priorities list on the website that they announced, and I saw, you know, no mention of immigration. Even in some of the areas that they talked about, there was hardly any mention of immigrants, right? On racial justice, on, you know, economic recovery, everything that they said, there was hardly any mention about immigration.
Climate change. They're all connected.
They're all connected.
Right.
But there wasn't even like one mention of how it was connected to immigration. And so to me, the fact that it's not even part of their priorities, and I know it's just the website, but, you know, we all lived through the Obama era. We all saw that it was so easy, you know, through rhetoric to say that they supported immigrants. But then when we started actually trying to negotiate with the White House on DACA, on DAPA, on a lot of these policies, we saw over and over again that, you know, they didn't want to do it. It was not a priority for them. And I hope that changes. I don't know. I mean, I can hope, but I'm not seeing it yet.
Yeah. You know, one of the things of all this in terms of the narrative, right? And again, you're all touching upon it, every one of you. That's why I like rolling with the three of you like the Wiz. Can we just like go down the yellow brick road for a second? I'm still stuck on that. But we also want to talk about some of the biggest moves, right, that Biden has made for immigration already. I mean, I've written about this and we've talked about it. But there are some picks for his various roles in this administration. And one of the first ones is Cuban-born Alejandro Mayorkas, who's Cuban-American. He will be the first Latino head of DHS if he gets appointed and confirmed. Pili Tobar, who I know, and I know other people on this show know, who worked with the immigration advocacy group, America's Voice. She was appointed a deputy communications director for the Biden administration. Then Javier Becerra, there we go, rolling the R's like I'm supposed to, was nominated for secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, which makes him the first Latino in that role, if confirmed, right? But there's all this notion of activists are still very skeptical of what impact this representation will really make, and wondering if these appointments are just to soften the blow. Because I think those are questions that are coming out. Nana, what do you think about these Latino picks, or just in general, this diversifying and the whole notion of representation as maybe softening the messaging or the blow of policy? Is it just a miscalculation of the problem? What do you think the impact will be?
I think that I find it interesting that people are desirous of the privilege to make the same mistakes that have been made in the past, as opposed to learning from the mistakes of the past. So again, there's something that we have in our in our immigrant rights movement where we somehow think that our situation is going to be different than that of the Black people who gave over 400 years to this country. Obama was a Black president, right? And I can go down the line in the elected office world and talk about the ways in which having Black folks in high places
right.
has not meant that you didn't have harm, right? So they're talking about mm-hmm. having, for example, a Black man be the Secretary of Defense. Mm-hmm. I don't think that my people on the continent of Africa or in the Caribbean or in South America or Central America should be doing a dance of joy mm-hmm. and thinking that all of a sudden they're not going to be getting bombed, et cetera, right? And right. we know that that doesn't mean anything because it's the structures, it's the institutions, it's not just the individuals. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have some friends within the glass house, but it doesn't stop the fact that we still have needs and that they are only going to be able to provide so much. And then lastly, I'll say this, the immigration policies of this country are based upon a notion of the dehumanization of the non-citizen, right? And citizen really being defined as the white person.
Exactly.
And so when we look at whoever we have in charge of Homeland Security, mm-hmm. the question is, as long as it's Homeland Security and they're dealing with people in ways that deny them their human respect and deny them their human dignity, it doesn't matter who's there pulling the levers. If that was true for Obama, it's going to be true for Mayorkas and every other Black and brown migrant that they put in these positions. And we have to be clear on that because there's no privilege mm-hmm. to repeating basic errors, you know, that we have done, you know, up into the present. It's no privilege. We need to try to do better and we must do better.
Right. Because it's like reform. Are you kidding me?
Right.
Reform. Yeah. Erica, did you have some thoughts on that?
I completely agree. This is one of the things that is really, really hard for me when I see another press release saying, you know, we just hire this Latina, Latino, you know, or whatever the identity into this specific position. So now we're good, right? We're good to go. This is, we marked the little box there, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard for me to just not cringe and roll my eyes because we were, again, going back, and I know we have a lot of scars from the Obama era and I'm just kind of showing them right now. But the hard part is, like, you know, Javier Becerra is a huge example of this. I mean, I remember every single time we were trying to push for DACA, this is something that's already in place that the American public loves in every poll, right?
Right.
This is a policy we're pushing in 2011, 2012, and people like him and others who were in power, who are people of color or Latinos, right? They were opposing it and they were pushing back against activists and against all of us who were pushing for that. And now, you know, it's a reality and now people are defending it. And so, to me, it has to be more than that. We have to have representation in these, you know, positions of power, but it goes beyond that. It's also about the ideology and also the accountability that has to be taken from them. Like, if they're going to be in positions of power, they have to understand that there's going to be accountability in the actions that they take from the activist community and the organizing community. We're going to have to do it because it's just, that's how democracy works.
The other thing is that immigration does not mean non-Black Latinx.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And when I'm asking, as the ED of Baji, as a Black migrant-rooted woman, what does this person's, you know, Mayorkas, what does his nomination mean for Black people?
Right.
And you can't answer the question?
Mm-hmm.
You literally have nothing to say, but we think it's going to help all people.
Exactly.
That's a complete insult.
Exactly.
You know, it's a complete insult. And it shows for Black migrants that, hey, we're on our own and we're going to, you know,
right.
Latinx,
true.
Asian, Muslim, if you're Black, we're going to have to figure out how to make this happen ourselves. Mm. And that is not what should be happening.
We need to talk about this from the level of dehumanization.
Othering,
right?
Yeah.
We experienced the dehumanization in frontal ways, the murder of George Floyd in front of our faces. The dehumanization of immigrants is something that is so sinister and seeped into everything. And that's why it's so dangerous, the fact that it wasn't named as one of his top priorities, because it's a bigger issue we're talking about here. It's not just immigration. It's a much bigger issue about where is your head and where are your values.
And Biden isn't going to be just inheriting these last 4 years of the horrific Trump immigration policies. He's coming into office at a time when we're facing one of the worst health crises in history in this country, which has disproportionately impacted Black and brown communities. We all know this. So, Erica, on the Homeland Insecurity podcast, you recently did an episode about COVID in detention camps. Yeah. Let's take a listen.
When the pandemic hit, immigration advocates, lawyers, and the people detained inside started clamoring for release.
The officers have masks and we don't. We're quarantined in our dorms. We cannot leave. Please help us get out of here.
I don't feel safe at all. And this is not only me. Everybody here is feeling the same thing.
This is Dr. Siru Sarsgari. He is 60 years old and has a history of pneumonia and lung infection, which means he's high risk for COVID-19. He called us from Wayne Correctional Facility in Louisiana. He was detained there in late March of 2020.
With respect to coronavirus, it's absolutely dangerous.
He's terrified that COVID-19 is going to kill him while he's trapped in this place. Dr. Asghari is a material science professor at Sharif University of Technology in Iran. He came to the States in 2017 for what he thought would be a short visit to meet his daughter's fiancé. While he was on his flight coming here, the U.S. canceled his visa. When he landed, he was arrested for allegedly stealing trade secrets on previous trips, as well as visa fraud. He was released on bond and stayed with his daughter while fighting his case for 2.5 years. The judge threw out the case mid-trial, citing that there was not enough evidence that Dr. Asghari had done any of the things he was accused of. With this acquittal, he was finally ready to go back home to his wife in Iran. But instead, he was taken into ICE custody. Because of all the news about coronavirus, Dr. Asghari asked a friend to pack a few masks and send his stuff to him in detention.
I spoke to the management over there and requested the mask for myself and three others, which were, you know, two of them elderly, and he said no.
You heard that right. He brought his own mask to detention, and the management wouldn't let him or anyone else use them.
And, you know, what this story really does is it humanizes the impact of this system and the dangers of COVID in detention camps. And we've been reporting on the tragic cases of COVID deaths in these places and the lack of testing and healthcare access for detainees who, by the way, read, write, watch TV, know the news. Mm-hmm. Like, the people want to be painted as like they're just some, you know, massive brown mat. No.
Yeah.
They want help and they know that they deserve it.
Yeah. Right. And we also know that there's so many inequities, right? It's Latino and Black communities, they're about 4 times more likely to be hospitalized for COVID than others. Mm-hmm. And that's according to the CDC. And of course, essential workers who've had to continue working through this pandemic are from immigrant communities, and many of them are undocumented. And the millions of undocumented immigrants in this country weren't able to benefit from any federal coronavirus relief. And access to healthcare is a huge problem. We've been talking about the glimmer of hope with the vaccine. And on Monday, the first person in New York received the coronavirus vaccine. She's a Black woman nurse in Queens who's part of this first phase of rollouts going to frontline healthcare workers. But when it comes to vaccine distributions, there's still distrust in Black and brown communities who have for decades faced racism in healthcare. So, yeah. Erica, talk to me a little bit more about the pandemic's impact on immigrant communities.
First of all, there's no reason right now why we have immigrants in detention, period, right? Regardless of COVID. But just the fact that you add this layer of danger into people's lives who are currently detained because they're waiting for an immigration judge to hear their case.
Yeah.
Right? Somebody who's here just asking for asylum, or, you know, who's here waiting to see if they're going to be able to stay. And they have to wait in a detention center because of the current policies. And now they're fearing for their lives. So to me, this is a no-brainer that should have, you know, been fixed a long time ago. And I really, really hope, well, it's not just the hope of it, but also we're going to be pushing for the Biden administration to ensure that we are shutting down these detention centers. We want just real quick story. You know, when we started working under COVID, you know, at Raices, a lot of our attorneys actually represent people who are inside of detention centers, both in family detention, where there's mothers, fathers, and children, and also adult detention. And since the very beginning, people literally learned about the pandemic because they're watching the news on television, not because of the guards, right, not because of the actual detention center, but because of TV, they learned there was a pandemic.
Wow.
And so to me, since that very, very beginning was a sign that they were not going to do everything in their power to ensure that people were not getting the virus. And so it's been a really tragic situation, and we got to do something about it. Now there's going to be a Democratic president, right, who says he supports immigrants. So that should be a first test. And obviously, you know, our people are at the front lines. They're the ones cooking our food. They're the ones who are picking our food from the fields and cutting the meat, right, that a lot of us are eating. And so it's just really unfortunate that even when there was COVID relief bills that happened, you know, we were pushing also Democrats in the House to ensure that, you know, there was also protection there for people who were undocumented. People who were undocumented could also get a check,
right?
Because they were also workers.
Right.
And nobody pushed for that.
Yeah. At the risk of being called an open borders advocate. That's, you're right.
Yeah. And it just, we know that it's not right. And we also know that those people who are essential, and I don't like to just talk about immigrants over labor because we contribute so much more and we're human beings. But
yeah,
just the fact that our communities are the ones feeding America in so many ways and doing so much more to keep this country alive. And we can't right. even have a $1,200 check. Exactly. That's just, to me, it's just insane to think about that.
Yeah. And, you know, and the other thing about all this, besides what's happened with this pandemic, it's this historic resurgence of the movement for racial justice in defense of Black lives. And we also know that just because Trump lost the election, you know, it's like white supremacy doesn't all of a sudden go away. I mean, it was here way before Trump. We know that, you know, American history can attest to that, and it will continue to be here. And actually, over the weekend, there were protests in Washington, D.C. by Trump supporters, including around 200 members of the far right hate group, the Proud Boys, who rallied to dispute the election. The protests led to violence, including multiple stabbings. And so while people are on the streets fighting for Black liberation and immigrant rights, there's still this contingent who is actively organizing against these communities. We've talked on the show before about how immigration in this country is rooted in the anti-Black and anti-Indigenous origins of this country. And you know, Nana, this is something that you were saying previously. Right. We know this. Anti-Black racism is prevalent when it comes to immigration, and that immigration advocacy has always been multiracial. And the movement really owes so much to Black organizing.
So, Nana, we were actually together virtually for the NIIC, the National Immigrant Integration Conference, and you spoke on a panel about what liberation looks like.
We got to keep growing that power on the outside of what I'm going to call the glass houses of state power, right? While intervening with state power on the inside in support of our folks who are standing outside, you know, with the batons, the bullhorns, some cases the bats in their hands, right? Looking for liberation. And we need to do that with the liberation of our people as our goal, not just the achievement of the American dream. And I say that because we know that the American dream requires anti-Blackness and racism, colonization of indigenous people, poverty, cages, and other forms of oppression for its existence. Without those things, there is no American dream. And so really, we're talking about liberation. We're talking about decolonization as our goal. That's what we really want. We want the government to stop killing us, to stop caging us, to stop separating us, to stop running us through these obstacle courses to permanent protections for our families and our communities.
And, you know, all of these things are connected forever. The data is showing now that the largest group of immigrants in detention right now are from Haiti, making up nearly half of all detainees, which means that the people being held in these camps are Black. And since December 10th, immigrant rights groups across the country have been participating in National Days of Action, calling for the release of all immigrants currently being jailed in detention.
Yeah.
It's part of the ongoing hashtag Free Them All abolition movement that calls for an end to incarceration of all forms, whether it's prisons or detention camps. And more recently, the movement is demanding for people in prisons and detention camps to be released for their safety due to the pandemic. So, Nana, can you talk more about the disproportionate impact that Black immigrants face right now in the United States and how the movement for racial justice and immigrant justice really is one and the same?
It's absolutely one and the same. And thank you for this opportunity to talk about that. I mean, when we look at, again, who is a citizen and who is human in the United States are the same question. In fact, in the United States, U.S. rights, right, U.S. civil rights, U.S. constitutional rights are considered to actually be more important than human rights as, you know, designed and defined by the international world. And so when you look at who is a citizen and who is human, that started off as being the white person. Mm-hmm. And the Black person was the exact opposite of that. And in the same way that one drop of Black blood, quote unquote, made you not white, made you Black, and therefore not human and enslaved, right, or enslavable, the millions of drops of non-white individuals in the bloodstream of the United States, they fear, will define this country as non-white, which is, you know, one of the horrors of their life, right? Is that this country is not seen as a white country. And so much of the increase in what we see as a racial terror is a result of the understanding that if you shake the family tree of the United States of America, a whole bunch of non-white people are going to come falling out of that tree. And there's a concern there about what that means about the identity, the racial identity, the cultural identity of this country, which was never white to begin with, because there were indigenous people here, and then they dragged and kidnapped and enslaved millions of African people to come here. So I think it's important. I think it's important for us to think about immigration in the context of the 14th Amendment, of African Americans as the original OG naturalized citizens. They were not citizens because they built the country. They were not citizens because they contributed to the economy. None of that meant anything because they were not white. They had to have 400 years of resistance, of civil war, and a constitutional amendment to be able to be citizens through the 14th Amendment. And you see, this is one of the things that the Trump administration is attacking, birthright citizenship, right? Mm-hmm. And so even to today, the Black roots of immigration are clear. Now, when we look at the disproportional way in which it affects Black people, 8% of the immigrant foreign-born population in this country is Black. But 20% of the folks who are looking at being deported are Black. You are 76% likely to be deported from this country if you have a prior conviction. And again, we know that that prior conviction doesn't have to be, you know, anything major. It can be small, you know, things that normally would be a misdemeanor can subject you to being deported regardless of your status. I don't care if you have a green card. I don't care if you're a refugee. I don't care what your situation is, as long as you're not an actual U.S. citizen, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's also been the efforts to denaturalize. Our bails are higher. We're six times more likely to be held in solitary confinement. And when you look at the deportation of our people, especially in these last couple of months, it has been atrocious. Shameful is not even the word. Mm-hmm. The ways in which this administration has had no problem separating our families, has had no problem exporting COVID back to our countries through the deportation of people who have COVID, whether they're symptomatic or not. And when we look at the asylum laws and the ways in which asylum has always meant remain in Mexico at the southern border for Black folks, even before the remain in Mexico policy, to the left and to the right, up, down, and all the way around, with every policy that restricts, limits, harms migrants, you find that Black folks are disproportionately affected.
Okay, let's move on to our final segment, which we call COVID coping.
So we are all here at Futuro Media, and even though we're all in our homes, we're going to shut down the offices, as it were.
Yay!
Yay! And so we've heard that, you know, this might be a difficult winter, a little stir crazy being with the same people that you've been with for like day in and day out, or none at all, which is hard too. We want to be safe. We want to think about other people, protect ourselves and others. Mm-hmm. So We're all trying to find peaceful moments. You know me, I just look at birds. But how are you finding joy and hope during these difficult times and into this holiday season? Erica, let's start with you.
Oh, it's hard. It's really hard. But I think for me, you know, just my family always helps me, you know, keep myself grounded. And I'm trying my best to follow through with meditation every morning because I stopped doing that. And I'm just realizing that I really, really need it. I need to get back into it. And I'm also taking a little bit of a break. I definitely feel really tired. And I think in order to get back strong into this fight, you know, we have to be well in order to have a amazing movement that's vibrant and that is rooted in love and that is rooted in justice. We have to take care of ourselves. So
yeah,
hopefully I can manage to do that through the break if nothing crazy happens in the outside world.
And Nana, how are you COVID coping?
My Broadway musical friend?
Yes, I definitely am going to be listening to Broadway musicals. You know me. So I will be listening to those because I love all those songs. And music is going to be throughout the house to make sure that we keep our energy up. I take the solstice seriously. It is like one of the serious parts of the year for me. I take that time right around the solstice to reflect and to think and to dream and to imagine what it is that I would like to have happen and what I want for us and our communities going into the next year. And so I know that I'm going to have a lot of deep thinking and conjuring, brouhaha conjuring to do to make sure that we can cast a few spells and get ourselves further along into next year. I really wish I was going home to Ghana, but it's not safe. Not because it's not safe in Ghana. They have like way less numbers in terms of people infected and people that are dying. But I'm really concerned that, you know, most of us, if we have the chance to go home, this is a time when we go.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I'm hoping that folks will heed the warnings and stay home and not bring COVID with them over back into our home countries, which are much less capable of handling it if it gets out of control. And so far, we're doing great in comparison, still terrible, the lives that have been lost. But in comparison to the U.S., we're doing fabulous. So we got to try to keep that up.
It was so great to have you both on our show. Eric Andiola, Chief Advocacy Officer for Raices and host of the Raices podcast, Homeland Insecurity. And Nana Jamfi, attorney and executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. Thank you so much for bringing it to the show with Julio and me today. It was really, really great.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Dear listener, please go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. Also, remember, you can listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you choose to get your podcasts on. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell everyone you know to listen. In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell, Noor Saudi, and Harsh Nahata, with editorial support from Erica Dilde. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, Leah Shaw, Elisheba Itu, and Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Captain ZZK Records. We'll see you on our next episode, dear listener. Hasta la próxima. See you later. Bye.
Stay safe, y'all.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.